This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have a guest who is, he's going to hate this, but he's a living legend. And he was first on Dreamland many years ago for UFOs in the National Security State, a groundbreaking work, which remains one of the most important books about the UFO subject ever written. Richard Dolan has also co-authored a speculative book about the future called AD After Disclosure, an analysis of something we might find out quite soon, how UFO secrecy might end, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which is an absolutely extraordinary look into the phenomenon through the eyes of a very strong mind and brilliant scholar. I'm so pleased that Richard Dolan is back with us on Dreamland, and we're going to be exploring, or perhaps I should say diving into, the issue of USOs underwater. And since I live just about 4 miles from one of the biggest UFO underwater bases on the planet, I'm particularly interested in this discussion. Richard, I'm very pleased to welcome you to Dreamland today.
Whitley, thank you. It's always a pleasure to see you. And I will just, you kind of alluded to this, but the reality is you were the very first radio interview I ever did. You were the host. You interviewed me on Dreamland. It was back in 2000. And I remember how excited I felt because I knew very well who you were. And I thought, what a great way for me to start in my public career. I get interviewed by you. And that was a really fun interview, as I recall. So, and I've always admired you ever since. And I'm always glad to be on your program.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, you were one of my firsts. You and William Henry and Peter Lavenda were all first appeared on Dreamland. And because when I read UFOs in the National Security State, I thought, this guy's got it. This is serious. This is a major book. And folks, by the way, if you're a subscriber, you can listen to that interview. In fact, I'll put a link up to it try to get them to put a link up to it when they write the blurb for this. So it should be on the Unknown Country website. You can listen to it. It should be fun.
It was in October of 2000.
Okay, now you said 2000. I realize I might not have it, but if I do have it, I'll put it up. Okay, all right. So let's get into this situation. Why did you decide to write about underwater UFOs? That superficially seems like kind of the wrong direction.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I'm always following my curiosity. This is my number one compass, is what am I curious about? What do I want to know about? I had been curious about the UFO phenomenon for more than 30 years. I want to have understanding, and that's really what it always comes down to. So I've spent many years studying the aerial aspects of this phenomenon. I've always been fascinated by the few water-based cases that you hear about over the years. I recall many years ago reading Ivan T. Sanderson's excellent book called Invisible Resonance. He did that back in 1970, and that was, at the time, the first English language book on USOs. It's very good, but there really wasn't very much done on it. I mean, Sanderson's work wasn't even comprehensive. It was good, and then we had to wait decades before anyone else even ventured in. It was the late Carl Feind who did a book in around 2010. That's about it, not a few others. So I was looking at a USO case from 1945, which is actually featured in this first volume, near the Aleutian Islands. That's one of the better known cases. And for my website, at Richard Olin Members, someone had asked me about it. And a lot of times I'll put together little video presentations on various things. So I did it on that. And that just got me interested. This was in 2022. And I thought to myself, why don't I just explore this a little more? And the immediate problem I found was, where do I find these cases? Where are they collected? How do I look for these USO cases as opposed to just aerial UFO cases. And I realized they are scattered everywhere. There's no single home for them. And I wanted to collect them. So I went on a search and rescue mission, in a sense. And it just kind of snowballed through the summer of 2022, where I really made it a focus. And at some point that summer, I thought, let's turn this into a book project. It was a much larger book project than I thought. This will be released as three complete volumes. Each will be about, I think, 400 pages. And I've covered, collected about 700, just under 700 USO cases that I personally have confidence in, that I think are worthy of consideration. And ultimately, my goal was simply to give new life to these cases. They have been completely forgotten. They were, you know, in the case of probably every single witness there, they were undoubtedly the most extraordinary thing that ever happened to them. And most of these people themselves are completely forgotten. In fact, often not even that. They've just probably never remembered to begin with. A lot of the cases that are in here were handwritten notes to some UFO organization where I think they were just filed away, and I doubt they were even investigated for the most part. So I thought that's a shame. And then beyond that, though, there's an element to this phenomenon. If we want to understand it properly, we need to know what is their scope of operations. We know they're over land in the air. We know they somehow interact with water. What is the exact nature of that? If we are really to understand this phenomenon, and you know this better than just about anybody, I think, then we need to do our best to understand who they are, what they are, where, you know, can we develop any motivations? Can we understand the nature of their society, their mind? And so all of it, I think, you know, is something I tried to do with the study of this USO phenomenon.
One of the things that I'm most impressed with is the fact that quite a number of the most important people in this field have stepped up and said a few things about this book, which I think are important, and I'm going to read them over the course of the interview. Tim Gallaudet, U.S. Rear Admiral, retired, says Richard Dolan's history of USOs could not come at a more critical time. His comprehensive and wide-ranging work reinforces our relatively recent awareness that UAP are observed in all domains, and the vast majority may be in our oceans. Dolan's seminal three-volume set on USOs will surely bring about a sea change in how humanity understands anomalous phenomenon. And I think that quote is particularly telling because, how I envy you, your wonderful quotes, because none of these people would ever give Whitley Strieber a quote, "I'm too weird." I'm serious, they would not. Well, not even Gary, whom I love and is a dear friend. I'll tell you, Jeff Kripal wrote a foreword for The Fourth Mind, which will be on it shortly. Diana Pasulka wrote a preface, and Jim Semivan wrote a nice quote, and so did Jacques Vallée. So it's not a total wasteland. But in any way, Tim Gallaudet has searched for USOs off the coast here, right near here, where I'm in Santa Monica, for those of you who do not know. Carol and Corey did a documentary showing USOs coming up out of the water right off of the tip point of Catalina Island. And can you tell us a little bit about what Tim Gallaudet then did?
Actually, I don't know what Tim Gallaudet did in that particular instance. I can certainly talk about Catalina Island. It's a very active area for UFOs and USOs.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. I'll work in Tim Gallaudet, because I heard him give a speech about what he did.
Well, yeah, I know he's been out there, and I just specifics on this particular, I don't think that I know.
But, okay. Well, let's talk about that. That's a bit more important anyway.
There are certain areas. One thing that I did when I put this study together is I, on my little Google Earth, I put little yellow pin marks on every single case, dated them, and so forth. They're really nicely organized, I have to say. I've gotten them broken down by decade, and I can select, you know, if I want 1960s or 70s. But anyway, when you look at it that way, you can I can definitely see patterns as to where the concentrations of sightings are. One clearly is Puerto Rico. One clearly is the area around Florida and even up the U.S. eastern coast. But one absolutely is by Catalina Island and the Channel Islands a little more generally. But Catalina Island in particular, it's very, very active. Lots and lots of reports there. And they go back, you know, many decades. And they are dramatic. They're more than dramatic. Some of them are just absolutely shocking. Some of them involve cases of missing time. Some of them involve sightings of very bizarre phenomenon tracked under the water. Some of them will involve transmedium objects seen emerging from the water or sometimes in a controlled descent into the water as well. So there's a lot there. It's been tracked on a regular basis, quite regularly since the 1970s, even a few earlier than that. So there's, you know, all kinds of speculation. What is down there? Is there a base? And then you have other people wondering, well, there's a lot of U.S. Navy activity there. Are these Navy activities that actually are people think are UFOs? I don't think so, incidentally. I believe that for an instant. What it looks like to me when I study the behavior of these objects, which I have tried to do, I've tried to even to do a kind of a statistical breakdown of it. But my conclusion is that they are definitely interested in the world militaries, certainly the U.S. Navy, certainly the Russian Navy and other nations as well. And I suspect that this is a big reason why we get a lot of UFO sightings in military areas. It's not, in other words, that the military is creating their own, you know, tic-tac UFOs and flying them around. No, I don't think so. I think it is clearly, to me, a matter of these others, these visitors, these beings, and they are watching us very carefully. And I think Catalina Island is one, seems to be one key area of several where they operate.
Now, interestingly enough, it's not near a military facility. There's an awful lot of UFO activity off San Diego, where the U.S. Pacific Fleet is headquartered. But why Catalina Island, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, if you're operating a flying saucer that actually has got some nice propulsion, Catalina Island to San Diego is probably a quick little jaunt anyway. So it might be quite convenient. I could imagine. But I don't know. I wonder, you know, I have wondered, are there geological features about that area under the water that I'm not aware of that might make it an attractive place? Certainly, this is the case. I don't want to jump direction too quickly here, but over by Puerto Rico, you know, north of that island is the great Puerto Rico, the San Juan Trench, the Puerto Rico Trench, which is the, I think it's the second deepest trench in the world. It's very deep, it's very long. And that's, there have been a number of USOs seen in that vicinity. And I do suspect the place where they may be hanging out also.
We need to take a brief break, Richard. And when we get back, we're going to be exploring a little bit more of why they would be and where in the places that they are. We'll be right back. We're talking to Richard Dolan. Richard Dolan's website is richarddolanmembers.com. His new book is about USOs. Darn it. I'm sorry, folks. It's called A History of USOs, and I messed up my I'm working from my Kindle because I didn't.
Welcome
I
to my know. World.
I do this. Yeah, exactly. In any case, it's called A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects. And before we stopped for our free Dreamlanders to for you to enjoy some ads, which I hope you will take seriously, we were talking about various bases. And I want to get back to Catalina Island, because this was obviously of personal interest to me, since I can actually see from the beach or from the bluff half a mile from my house. I can look out across the water directly across to where it is. And I have seen UFOs come up out of there every once in a while, not often, once or twice only, but there have been plenty filmed. And yet, it's not like Puerto Rico, where you can see a lot of additional, and we'll get to this, activity of people having experiences. So, because you don't see a lot of that in the Santa Monica area. I know that because, you know, I'm a magnet for these things. And people who live around me, all of whom know me, and I mean, I walk down the street and, it's a Whitley Strieber sighting. You know, there are people like train spotters, do celebrity sightings around here. And I have, strangely enough, ended up as a celebrity, which is very peculiar. In any case, no one comes up to me and says, you know, I had this experience and I live over on 4th Avenue or something. It never happens. I just wonder if you know of any cases that are clustered around near where this particular base is, maybe on Catalina itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a number that will appear in the second and third volumes of this study. And I'm trying to remember exact dates, but I can definitely tell you. I know of one case right off the top of my head of missing time connected to Catalina Island. It's really quite remarkable. And this was, I believe, in the late 1980s, I think 1988. So that'll be in the volume two of this study. It involves a man who was did a lot of boating back and forth from the mainland to Catalina Island. He was a licensed scuba diver as well. So he was very capable in the water. And near midnight during one summer, I think it was in 1988, he's taking his boat from the mainland and he's trying to reach two harbors, Catalina Island. So for people who are not familiar, if you look at the island close up on the west northwestern side, it kind of pinches in and there's kind of like two harbors, one on either side. So that's where he was aiming for. So at around midnight, he landed at Catalina Island, but he was too far east. So he didn't exactly navigate it perfectly. So he had to, rowed his boat along the coast, or close enough to the coast, I guess, in the direction of two harbors. And about 10 minutes into this adjusted journey, he looks at the water below him and he sees this for about 15 seconds only. This enormous square and like a well-defined square of gold yellow light from below the water. It had sharp edges and it was, he estimated, at least 100 yards in either direction. So one football field in this direction, one football field in that direction. This yellow square lighting up beneath him, beneath his boat for about 15 seconds. So that's bizarre. He didn't have any sighting of any craft associated with this, but he continued on his journey. He ends up at two harbors, and he realizes he is 2 hours late. He's lost 2 hours of time, and he really didn't think about, like, this happens to so many people who've had these experiences. They have something extraordinary happen, and they brush it off, or they don't think about it, or they even... This is mind-blowing, but they will forget about it for a certain period of time. There's clearly cognitive manipulation going on there. But in his case, he said, well, a few years later, I learned that there were these potential USOs or water-based, you know, UFOs. And he said, oh, maybe that's what I encountered. And then, you know, sometime after that, he just wrote about it like so many people do to an online website, which is how I found his story. So that's back in 1988. And that is not the first time, by the way, or the only time that people reported this kind of yellowish, well-defined light in the water near Catalina Island. And in this one man's case, it seemed to involve, I would have to say, a potential abduction experience.
Yeah, I would think so, because, you know, missing time is ipso facto. It's time you don't know what happened in it. Yeah. That, you know, Tim Gallaudet said about a year and a half ago that he wanted to mount an expedition to that area and dive it.
Yeah, I recall this. Yes, absolutely.
Do you know what happened to that?
Well, I don't think it's happened yet. What I've learned, it's very easy. Like, if you're not an expert in the water, and I will have to emphasize, I'm still not an expert about the water. I did a research on water-based phenomena. That doesn't make me an experienced sailor. I'm certainly not. But one thing that I have learned is that getting the technology down into the water is not easy. Even if you're near the coast, it's not always easy. I talked with Tim on one occasion about the, you remember the underwater or alleged underwater base by Malibu. You know, everyone saw this on Google Earth. Jimmy Church talked about it for a while. And I know there's been some discussion about it. And I know, pardon me, my phone, I'm going to ignore that. And I know that geologists have said that this is undoubtedly a natural phenomenon, or maybe there's, you know, defect of a resolution of it. Who knows? But the obvious solution is you send an ROV down there to record it and get a close-up vision of it. And this has not happened. And I remember chatting with Tim about it. I beg your pardon?
That's the strange part. It hasn't happened. And it's so easy, it's not even deep.
Well, I think it's several hundred feet down there. It might even be 1,000 feet
down. Sorry, I'm mistaken. I thought it was 70 feet deep. It's several hundred feet. Well, it's a more expensive proposition to do that.
It's not impossible, but even investigating something like that it's not just a walk in the park. We're getting better with these ROVs and they're called AUVs and all these other types of, and now only recently are we able to operate some of these so that they're not attached by a cable to a ship, you know?
Right.
So we're getting better, but it's not the easiest thing. And visually, you know, when we get down even below 100, 200 feet of the water, it's basically inky black. Or it's like a dense London fog where you can't see more than a few feet in front of you. It can be very difficult. So the visibility is difficult. You know, you have to rely on other means like sonar, and I don't know what other technologies they employ. But there's still a lot that we do not have tracked down there. In terms of Catalina Island, it seems to me a very, like, that's an obvious place that should be explored. Maybe the U.S. Navy has already explored it. Wouldn't be shocking to me, but they don't like to talk.
No, Tim Gallaudet said at the Seoul Foundation conference this year that he had decided that the little seamount that he thought might be the entrance to the base was just geology, and he wasn't going to go down. Hmm. And I wondered if that was the real reason. Because when you think about it, going down to explore an alien base in scuba gear might be a fairly dangerous thing to do. And in any case, right now, as I understand it, he doesn't have any plans to explore around Catalina Island. Maybe he's going to explore somewhere else nearby. I don't know, but I don't know him well enough to talk to him. So,
lots of rumors of different locations in that general area that are worth exploring. Catalina Island is one, but there's a lot of others in the Southern California area, and particularly near Malibu, LA. And it would be nice to explore.
Let's continue talking about this area because, you know, and we're going to talk about, we're going to move to Puerto Rico, then we're going to go to Florida. Because the book, by the way, folks, is just fascinating. It's one of these things where you think, underwater UFOs, do I really want to go there? And then it turns out, yes, you do. You do very badly want to go there because it's a fabulous. Oh, yeah. And he goes back into history and you realize that this has been going on for a long time. And then that occurs to me that let's segue for a second into the past and some of the earliest. This is on my, I usually have a physical book. But and it's on my Kindle, and every time I turn around, my Kindle, you know how slippery they are. It wants me to do something else. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the distant past before we move on down south to and explore California a little bit more. The early chapter about the past goes from 1717 to 1899. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about, well, let's try the first possible USO sighting that you mentioned in 1717.
Well, even before that, I actually had a prior chapter in which I explore the idea of even more ancient USOs. And I, you know, when I was collecting these cases, I wasn't ever trying arbitrarily to start at any particular point. I just wanted to go back. How far back are the is the first really like good USO case that I feel very confident about? And I explored things like, you know, the sighting by Christopher Columbus in 1492 as he approached the New World. And have a little conversation about that. And a few other even more ancient alleged legendary type cases. They may be, they may have truth in them, they may not. But I really try to have a fair discussion about that. And I will just say that compared to probably to a number of other people who researched this, I might be a little tougher on the idea of ancient aliens and a lot of other folks. I don't discount it. And I, in fact, I think that there is an ancient component to this phenomenon. But what I continually have come to believe is that that aspect of it might very well be much overstated. When I hear people say they've been here forever, I immediately say, well, who is the they that you're talking about? Is it the Greys? Is it someone else? Is it Nordic, you know, who looks just like us? Is it you know, whatever. I'd like to know. I want some specificity. And it's hard to get that. And then when I look at the ancient UFO reports, and I've looked at most of them, I think some are very good, intriguing. Others, I think, are overrated. So I try to have a cold eye when I look at these. Now, looking at the early USO cases, the first one that really made me think I believe this is from 1717. And it was a French ship off the coast of Martinique in the Caribbean. It was, I think, about 2 in the morning or 2:30 a.m., very late. There was a half moon out, so visibility would have been at least reasonable. And the ship's captain, he was a French captain, just noted in the log that along the ship was the way he described it, it was a shaft. He said it looked like the mast of a ship, but it was only a couple of feet long, and it was apparently above the water in a vertical orientation along the ship. Very, very strange. The thing about that report is that this captain was not trying to infer anything about it. It struck him as odd. He never tried to explain it in one way or another. He just simply noted it. You could ask yourself, well, did he have, was he fooled? But was there an optical illusion? And all of these things are possible. But I thought his observations seemed to be fairly clear. He seemed fairly confident about it, and I had no reason to discount it. So I thought this thing wasn't seen actually in the water. But look, if you're at 2:30 in the morning, you're in the middle of the Caribbean, and this little thing is hovering near your ship, I think we can count that as a legitimate case. And I thought that.
Yeah, and it's particularly interesting because of the fact that it almost sounds like a periscope. It almost sounded like a periscope. That was my reading of it.
Oh. Well, that's very interesting, and if that's the case, that's quite an unexplained phenomenon. There certainly were no periscopes in 1717.
Well, exactly, and well, of course, you know, we didn't really see UFOs until the 20th century. In the late 19th century, there were the airship mystery, and then suddenly a little while later, these things began to appear. I thought to myself, I've recently thought to myself, what if they actually just invented the UFO recently? But in any case, we're going to take another break. And then when we come back, we're going to go back to the future and to the present. And we're going to explore a little bit south of where we are now, into San Diego, the San Diego area. Then we're heading over to Puerto Rico. We'll be right back. We're talking to Richard Dolan. His new book, A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects. And his website is richarddolanmembers.com. This book has been given great support by some extraordinary and important researchers, among them Dr. Gary Nolan. Gary is, of course, is a friend of mine and of Richard's, and he has spoken very highly of the book and of the quality of Richard's research for a reason, because you really do learn something important in this book. And why would underwater UFOs be important, USOs? Well, one reason could be is the fact that it suggests they are established here, that these bases are an establishment that's not something recent. Let's move down to San Diego, Richard. Mm-hmm. And this is a definitely a military area. This is right offshore of the U.S. Pacific Fleet headquarters, where most of our naval activity takes place. It's the biggest fleet headquarters we have. So can you tell us a little bit about the kind of activity that occurs there?
I sure can. I pulled up my Google Earth with all of my little yellow pins so I can see the concentrations in that area. One thing I can just say immediately is that there's a bit of a higher concentration just north of San Diego in the area near LA and Catalina Island, just saying. Although there's still a lot that has been recorded in terms of USOs in the San Diego area, and then going down the Baja coast there. One of those cases, of course, in 2004 was the USS Nimitz, the Tic Tac encounter. That's in the general region there. And there's quite a few others. We know about the USS Omaha from July of 2019. That's in that general area. And quite a lot. I'm looking at cases from throughout the 21st century and many in the 20th century as well, 80s and 90s. There's a real pattern here. So one thing that I have noted is that almost every one of the ones I'm looking at here occurred at night, not in the daytime. I think maybe one or two might have occurred in the daytime, but by and large, these are nighttime encounters, especially when they involve the military. And they frequently will involve, and this is especially the case with military as opposed to civilian encounters, involve things like electromagnetic interference and some kind of situation where like compasses will go crazy or electronic systems will go down, computer systems will go down. Rarely, but it has happened where people have said weapons systems have also become inoperative at times. So there's a lot of that going on in the Southern California, Baja area off the coast. There's one of these cases actually that I tracked off the on the coast of Baja California, around the middle, from 1892, not from recently. This bright thing came in from the ocean. There was a hydrographic survey team in the area. They're measuring the ocean depths and things like this. Very scientific, and two men on that were on the shore. This thing comes in from the ocean, hangs around, practically blinds them, according to the one man, for about 10 minutes or more, and then it goes off inland, and that's the last they saw of it. There's a long history of some strange things going around in this area, and I do suspect that there's more than one base, frankly, of operations where these things are. It's hard to know for sure, but I strongly believe that because there's just so much activity here, and there's so much interest that I'm using that word loosely because I don't know who they are, but that they show in us, and they come in, they examine, and then they typically leave.
And you have to wonder what they're doing, because after all, this process of examining us seems to have been going on for quite a long time. And it may be that their minds just work differently than ours, that they are slower but more accurate.
You and I both think about this a lot. This is something that you think about and I also think about. And I've definitely developed my own theories as to why they're here and what I think that they're doing. And it's just a speculation. It's not based on any direct contact. with them, but it is based on my own assessment of the cases and the accounts. I would just say that I think there has been probably a long-term observation of us for in the thousands of years. I don't know how that worked. Is it some kind of a beacon or some kind of sensor or an occasional visits, and they just are monitoring our development, perhaps something like that? Yes, I suspect. But it certainly looks to me that their presence increased a bit during the 19th century, and I mean the early 19th century. There seems to have been a genuine uptick in reliably reported accounts. And then definitely and most prominently during and after the Second World War, this thing just went crazy. And that's really the big one, is World War II. And what I think is the case is that they know that we are on their path. This is what I believe. We're on the same kind of technological path that they are further down the road on. We, like them, have the ability of abstract thought. We can do mathematics. We can think creatively. We can do, maybe at a lower level, a lot of the things that they do. And I have no doubt that they see that in us. And they probably can predict our trajectory as well. And I suspect that they realize these humans, they don't stop. They keep going. When one of the things I looked at is the evolution of these encounters of the USOs during the 20th century. And, you know, you just think about our own technological progress during the 20th century. In the year 1900, that was actually the first year that we humans had a truly, you could say, a functional submarine. First time, and didn't go that deep, but we got in the water. It was able to stay in the water. It could operate. From that bare bones beginning, you know, we end up developing sonar. We end up developing better and better submarines. We eventually get, by the mid-century, nuclear submarines that can stay under the water forever, essentially. We started creating, after the World War II, this massive sonar array on the ocean floor for the Americans to detect Russian subs. Well, I'm pretty sure they were detecting other things as well. And so our eyes and ears kept getting better and better and better during that century, including in the atmosphere. You know, we started putting satellites up in orbit in the 1950s and 60s. And so if I'm them, I'm thinking we've had it easy. The humans are always observant, so we've always had to be careful, but now they're becoming even better at detecting things and detecting us. So how do we deal with that? And what I believe I have seen in these cases and in looking at some of the statistics that I've pulled out of it is that they made their own adjustments to us, particularly during the 1960s and very likely beyond. But they and we and they are doing, I liken it to a kind of dance. You know, we're seeing them, they're seeing us, we are starting to notice them, they are well aware of us, and they are adapting. And my conclusion, at least for now, is that I don't think they have any interest in announcing themselves formally to the world. I don't think it's anything like that, personally. My sense is that they are interested in doing their thing, which is monitoring humanity, monitoring Earth. I think Earth would be a very logical thing for them to look at. We have an amazing world. We have an incredible amount of life. Some of the sightings that I've seen take place in areas like the, you know, the depths of the Amazon jungle and river systems, where you've got incredible ecological diversity and tremendous value, and a number of other places like this. So I think they're interested in our planet. They're interested in our genetic diversity, of which we have a super abundance, and they are certainly interested in us. I wouldn't be surprised if they're interested in other life forms like whales, dolphins, other intelligent creatures. I would expect that, but I think they're definitely watching us because we're dynamic and we are potentially dangerous, where we can be exciting, and you know, I really suspect that human civilization might just be the greatest TV show in this part of the quadrant of the galaxy for right now. We may have brought in the whole neighborhood.
Well, I hope we're nothing more than entertainment. That's all I can say. Because being abducted and having your semen removed suggests otherwise.
Well, I'm going very easy here. I mean, there's much more invasive things happening, including cases of missing time and abductions and encounters. Absolutely. That's part of it, and that needs to be understood.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, I think we should segue a little bit, because every time I talk to a guest like you who's really serious, super knowledgeable, which I think would be an accurate description of your mental state, we're in this kind of disclosure situation, which I've been very wary of and very not actually all that interested in, because, you know, I mean, I live with the visitors in my life, so I don't exactly need anybody to tell me that they're real, as is, would be obvious from any books of my books, I hope. In any case, something seems to have happened, in the sense that we were racing toward a disclosure moment, and now people are backing off. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has kind of backed off. Representative Luna has become kind of silent, and the others are too. They're sort of backing away from it, and you know, they've had a number of hearings that were skiffed, you know, closed hearings recently, and out of that has come complete silence. And I know that my family were close to Lyndon Johnson, and I know that this came up and he expressed no interest and it was, the thing was given to Hubert Humphrey. But there it ends as far as I'm concerned. I just know that he was asked if he was interested. Jimmy Carter went into a briefing and came out and never said another word. Lou Elizondo has said that the hidden truth is somber. That's his exact word. And you look back now over, what is it? This is the 16th or 17th administration that has grappled with this issue. And so far, none of them have disclosed a thing, including the last Trump administration. So what are they hiding? Richard, do you have any sense of that?
I have theories. First of all, in this field, we need to really drop the kind of what I would say is a naive, almost utopian view of these other beings. You know, there's a lot of people who want them to save us from ourselves. It's understandable why. I mean, we've, you know, put ourselves into a very difficult spot as a civilization. You know, we've got these nation states that are armed to the teeth, peering at each other over the fence, ready to go to war. We're doing damaging things to the environment. Whether you're liberal or conservative, it's very difficult to deny we're doing a lot of damage to the global environment and probably putting the future existence of many species and perhaps ourselves at risk. All of this is true. It's all obvious. We're in a tough spot. So we instinctively, a lot of people want the aliens to save us, in a sense, from ourselves. And then, of course, there are people who are totally convinced that they are in some contact with benevolent intelligences and things like this. What I would say is, this is actually dangerously naive. I'm not even saying that all of it is untrue, but what I am saying is we need to understand an alien intelligence, and that is the phrase I want to use here, as realistic a manner as we can. I think it really would behoove us to. So what do I mean by that? I mean, they are therefore probably physical beings. They may be artificially modified. They may be artificially created. They may be all types of hybrids when we can consider the types of technologies that they would have in terms of genetic engineering and cybernetics. And, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities here. I must assume they are physically created. They have their own energy needs, therefore. That might include food. They may have their own interests. They clearly, based on every indication one can think of, have exceptionally high intelligence. And they are almost certainly exceedingly telepathic, whether naturally or through technology. Doesn't really matter to me. They show that capability. And I'm also going to guess that they're part of some kind of hive mind or collective network. So that gives a lot of advantages in terms of intellect and capability. And no matter what they are, they could be wonderful, they could be hostile, they could be indifferent, but even under the best circumstances, that is a tremendous challenge to us. I think people would really want to think about what would it be like to sit across from an ET being that probably has an IQ of 500 or more, can read into your naked soul and can also, you know, collect from its own hive mind and know every single thing, everything about you and everything. That's intimidating, if nothing else. That's the best way to put that.
Yes, I'm familiar with that form of intimidation, very familiar with it.
Indeed.
And speaking
of intimidation,
what? Yes.
Quite
speaking
quite
of intimidation, folks, don't be intimidated by these messages. We'll be right back. We're talking to Richard Dolan, his new book, A History of USOs, Unidentified Submerged Objects, and much more. We have segued into an exploration of the phenomenon itself as a, you know, what are they and where are they here? And I think Richard makes an excellent, important point that this is not all sweetness and light. These guys, whatever they are, wherever they're from, are not here. This is not the cavalry coming to save us. I think that if we end up in an endgame situation on planet Earth of one kind or another, whether it's nuclear war or an environmental collapse, and there's a threat of mass extinction, they might well show up. But I don't think that it's going to be fun at all. I think they're going to be really, really annoyed at us, and we're going to feel that.
I suspect we have a hard time dealing with them. You know, one of the people that influenced me the most on this is you. I read something of you more than 15 years ago. I can't remember where. It might have been on your website, one of your blog posts. And you talked very insightfully, I thought, about the kind of almost sheer terror that we would feel in the face of these beings. I think you, if I'm thinking right, you describe it almost like the way a frightened dog would feel toward his master. Defenselessness, essentially.
Yeah, well, these little inoffensive, insignificant-looking creatures are not insignificant when you're with them at all. They're very significant. They are, looking into their eyes is an extraordinary experience, whether they have those eye coverings on or not, if that is indeed correct. I believe it is, but in any case, they are of the grays. I'm talking about the grays now. I've had one sort of encounter with the tall whites and one encounter with one of the Nordic people. But the grays are the ones I've been with most of my life, and they are very, very powerful beings. I mean, they may be physically small, but they're not small, not at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I think that one of the problems is that the government doesn't know how to tell us this. Because I want to segue back into USOs from there. But you've got a response first.
You were talking about the silence like coming out of Luna's office, and you mentioned AOC. And if I could respond to that now, I think all of what we just said partly speaks to that. I think that I would bet pretty much anything that in those SCIFs, when they were having these classified briefings, I have no doubt that these members of Congress and senators were told things that are perhaps unsettling, and they may not know how to deal with this politically. And, you know, as a politician, you're thinking, well, what is the upside here? What do I get out of it? And it may not be all that clear. On top of that, I'm sure what they were told was just deeply, strictly classified. So I suspect that I'm not one of these people who think we're going to have disclosure. I have not believed that really at any point in these last 8 years. We have moved a long way publicly in our conversation since 2017, and that's a very good thing. But when you really step back and look at the big picture, I still maintain we're taking baby steps here. We're still at a point where there is no genuine disclosure. The government hasn't said it's real. The best that we get out of the Pentagon is we're looking into it now. There may be something there, which is a joke because the Pentagon knows full well what they are dealing with. And the USO study that I've done, in my view, absolutely proves that case closed. No question. The Pentagon knows absolutely what is going on with these USOs as well as the UFOs. And they do not have a way of describing this because they are outmatched by these things. They cannot control them. It's obvious these are not Russian or Chinese. That's absurd when you look into most of these cases. And they are, it's a case where they just have to throw up their hands. They have no way of dealing with this. So now the question is, well, what's the problem with them admitting that to the world? Well, I think there's a lot of problems with that. Because first of all, when you make this admission, we're not just talking about the United States government. We're talking about all governments around the world. And some of them will very possibly become destabilized by this. I'm thinking of China. It's a perfect example. I just did a independent study of Chinese ufology for my website. So it's kind of fresh in my head. And it's a fascinating story, but I'll just leave it here, which is that there is no question in my mind that the Chinese government is terrified of the idea of a UFO disclosure.
I'm getting on your website, and folks, just to remember that, it's richarddolanmembers.com. And what does that tell you about what you could do there? It's called members. Remember that, members. You support us, guys. We need you. We can't do this without you. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, appreciate it. I have a lot of free stuff on that site, by the way, as you do, but there is a paywall for certain things, too. Just saying the Chinese study that I'm very glad I did. I'm going to do a similar one with Russian ufology very soon. But in the case of Chinese ufology, it's very obvious the Chinese government, at the turn of this century, they had to clamp down significantly on too much speculation in the UFO community and against particularly the group called the Falun Gong, which was meditative practices, very spiritual, but also had very definite UFO beliefs as well. It's a fascinating history. I'll just leave it and say that a genuine UFO disclosure will have very major international repercussions. This is not just a little thing here. It affects the United States. It will affect China. It will affect Russia. Whether people like or don't like these countries is irrelevant. These are major countries. And, you know, we have to ask, will this lead to a destabilization of the international structure? It's not impossible. So there's a lot going on here in terms of disclosure. Will it really happen or not? I suspect I'm waiting for the Luna Committee to come out with more because they're talking about more than just UFOs and USOs, which they've mentioned. We're talking about the JFK assassination and the origins of COVID and 9/11. Hey, I want them to go to town on that, and I want to learn everything that they learn. I think those are all worthy areas. I'm afraid they're going to be set up to fail. It's my big fear about the Luna Committee. I don't know how much authority they really are going to have to get into these issues. You know, we've tried with JFK 50 years ago. They had the Church Committee, and they found a few things, and then they closed up shop and headed for the hills, and we never heard from them again. So I don't know what will happen in this case. I hope, I would like to see something come out of it, but I'm not going to hold my breath. I will say we're likely to get a couple more good whistleblowers this year and probably in the future. Not impossible. We will probably get a number of new revelations. But the thing is we've already had lots of revelations over the last 8 years. Many, and they have not led to disclosure. So I think we're able to handle a lot more than we thought and not have it rock the boat too much.
Yeah, and there's a documentary that was just at South by Southwest that hopefully will have found a distributor right now and be out when this is here. And there's also very good. And there was James Fox's The Program, which was also very good.
Absolutely.
But there is a problem here, and it's fundamental. These are narrative accounts. Some of them are from very powerful people who are very knowledgeable, like Hal Puthoff. I've known Hal for a long time and many years, and I can assure you that Hal knows the whole story. He knows the whole story better, as well as anybody alive ever has.
I agree.
And I know some others who've passed on who knew more of the story because they were on the direct interface, and that did exist and may still exist for all I know. That is real. And just as the bodies that were at Fort Detrick and may still be there are real. That's all real. In any case, what the problem is this, basically the scientific community can't get off the dime without material. They need biological material and they need the physical material. I know the physical material has been around for a long time because Roscoe Kellenkoder, I was told, and it was described to me, oh, darn it. I hate when one name comes in and another name, it overrides another name. And he'll come back to me. In any case, the material was being examined as long ago as the 50s. And when the electron microscope came in, those examinations ramped up. But it's all behind closed doors. It has to come out into the open scientific community so papers can be published in venues like Nature and Science. Otherwise, we will not get off the dime, no matter how much disclosure there is. They can say all they want. You know, there are aliens here. They can say that. And the public goes, oh, my God. But we don't get any progress unless science has something to work with.
As you were talking, I was listening to you, but I was also searching for a file of mine. When you were talking about the study of materials going back to the 1950s, I haven't found the file, but I know it. There's a man named John Center. He was a scientist over at the Patel Memorial Institute back in the 50s. And he talked about, and I'm going off of memory here, but he talked about how at Patel they obtained material from Wright-Patterson in the early 50s, the so-called metamaterial type stuff. And he said, we did a very detailed analysis of it. And we were said, well, you don't know where this came from. We're not telling you where. But he said, we all firmly believed it was extraterrestrial. And he had some description of this. I think that was in a very good book about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And the name of the author, it was a woman, it escapes me at the moment. I have it on my shelf somewhere. But anyway, so there, I think there's very good testimony, believable, credible testimony of genuine study of these materials, as you say, going back into the 50s, if not earlier.
Yeah. And the name I blocked on a moment ago, by the way, was Robert Sauerbacher, whom I mentioned on the show many times. And my Uncle Mickey, Edward Streber, was at Wright Pat at Air Materiel when the debris was brought in. He held it in his hands, my own uncle. So, yeah, I know it existed. But as I say, I corresponded for a while with Chris Mellon, and I said to him at one point, we don't get anywhere until this is materials are out in the public space. And he agrees. And I said, we need to put one of the intact objects, and there are some, in the Smithsonian. That's when we really begin to get started with this, and the public begins to get their heads around this. And we need to get the materials out into the scientific community that is not behind closed doors. Okay, enough said.
Agreed.
I want to get back to UFOs, our USOs, and there are some incredibly cool cases in this book, folks. And these cases are more than your usual UFO book cases, because we're talking here to a serious expert, probably one of the great scholars in this, the history of this field. I want to talk now about the Graham Bethune case, which is so extraordinary, but we have reached the end of the free section of the show, and we're going to say goodbye to the free Dreamlanders, and we're going to move on with the subscribers. Guys, thank you as always for being with us on Dreamland. And by the way, enjoy the new unknowncountry.com newsletter. It is much more informative and beautiful than the past one. Go on unknowncountry.com and subscribe to it. It's absolutely free, and it just may lure you into becoming a paid subscriber. Richard's website is richarddolanmembers.com. It is a beautiful, important site. Richard's material on there is among the most important material in this field. His new book is extraordinary. It's just the beginning. It's a three-volume set of UFOs, a history of UFOs, unidentified submerged objects. Thank you for being with us and subscribers. We're going to keep on keeping on. Okay, let's start with the Graham Bethune case. I'm really interested in this. I thought it was an extraordinary case.
Yes, I'm so glad you asked about it. It's one of my favorite cases as well. And you may have met him. I had the pleasure to meet Graham Bethune on one occasion back in 2004. He'd been long retired by then, but it was very, very nice to meet him. And we actually chatted a little bit about his encounter at that time. It was in New Jersey, as I recall. But Graham Bethune was a Navy pilot. And in early 1951, he is piloting a Navy transport plane from Iceland back to North America. He had a crew of, I think, three or four other Navy personnel flying the plane with him. He was in charge. And then they had a bunch of VIPs, Navy brass, upper-level Navy VIPs, on this plane too, like 20 or 30 people. So this was not a tiny little thing. So it's late at night. They're flying back from Iceland. They had just passed Greenland, and they were near, I think, Nova Scotia, approaching that area. And Bethune talked about this, and we actually have very good documentation on this from the U.S. government. But anyway, he looks down at the water. It's pitch black out there, but he sees a light emerging from the water below. Very unusual. They check. There's not any craft. There's nothing supposed to be around there whatsoever. The other co-pilot and other individuals in the cockpit are looking at this thing. And then they watch it zoom up from the surface of the ocean. And within a few seconds, it is right at their level. They're at something like 30,000 feet, right at their level, and it's off their the right wing of the aircraft. And he's watching it. It's a flying saucer. It's got rotating lights. Various multicolor lights are there, and this is a disc-shaped saucer. At times, the light was very bright. Everyone in the cockpit seeing this thing. And then it maneuvered. It maneuvered on various sides of the aircraft as they're flying this thing. It was obviously checking them out in a very serious way. And this whole thing lasted for, I think, about 5 minutes. And then eventually, after it was satisfied in examining them, it just flew off. When they landed, they were Bethune and his crew. Their immediate reaction while they were in the air was, we're not really going to talk about this to anybody. This is not a career outlook, a good career outlook for us. But they were asked about it upon landing. And he talked about this a number of times. He said the guys in the suits came. They did not identify themselves. We all assumed they were probably CIA. They ended up showing us photographs of UFOs. Did it look like this? Did it look like this? And so forth. And he also added, these guys knew a lot more than they were letting on. It was very, like, he and his crew all believed that. But that's essentially the case. So you have this object seemingly coming out of the ocean. Where else could it have come from? They saw the light first when it was seemingly on the ocean surface. So presumably it came from below the water and then just zoomed right up to their level, zipped around them a few times, and then was gone. It's quite extraordinary. And then, you know, listening, you read the Graham Bethune, we do have a fair amount of at least some declassified U.S. government documentation that does attest to this encounter. So this is not just some guy telling his story. reputable though he is. So that's the Grand Bethune account. And it's one that I was really glad to put that into the book. It belongs in there for sure.
Yeah, for sure it does. And you have to wonder, where exactly were they?
They were in the North Atlantic on the approaching the Canadian coast. So they were not far from Nova Scotia as they were coming in. They had just come from Greenland. They were passing by that.
Because, you know, if we had a sensitive area that's where with restricted overflight and someone overflies it, we inspect them in exactly the same way these people were inspected. Yeah. And I just wondered if there might be something underwater there that's very sensitive to the non-humans, the non-human intelligence, and that they saw this plane flying over it and wondered what was going on.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at it now on my map, and they were approaching Canada. That is, that's not Nova Scotia. That's Newfoundland. So they were south of Greenland at this point and approaching Newfoundland. They're maybe 160 miles, looks like northeast of Newfoundland when this accounted. In fact, it looks like I really tried very carefully to plot each case as accurately as I could on the map. Wasn't always easy to do that, but I tried. I think I'm very close on this one. And this looks like right where the shelf ends and you start getting into very, very deep water. You know, there's a very big Atlantic shelf off of the eastern U.S. seaboard there and Canadian. So a lot of that water on the shelf is just a few hundred feet deep. And then that shelf drops, of course, and you're getting into down to 15,000 feet very quickly. And this occurred right at the edge of the shelf, it looks like to me. There's a lot of cases where these USOs are on the shelf and cases where they're in the depths. So I'm not sure if it means anything particularly, but that is where this one took place.
Well, let's talk about now, you've identified several hotspots around the globe. Catalina, we've talked about Puerto Rico, we're going to talk about, but also like the South China Sea, you mentioned that mm-hmm. as being a do the three areas share any characteristics?
Well, one thing I want to say about hotspots is that I really want to be careful before I call any place a hotspot, because what I have seen is, you know, is a hotspot really a hotspot, or is it just we just have a lot of eyes and ears in that area? You know, one case in point, I'll just mention in passing almost, is the Italian coast in the Mediterranean. I have many, many cases from that area. Now, does that mean Italy is a genuine hotspot, the Adriatic Sea or the Tyrrhenian Sea? Maybe, but it could be that I know for sure that the Italian UFO community there is very active and very good at recording these things. So is that the case? Is that why I see a bunch of cases in near Catalina Island, because we've got a lot of eyes out there, or by Florida or by Puerto Rico? I suspect there's a lot of genuine activity in those places, but just because I'm not seeing a lot of sightings in a certain area does not tell me automatically that there's nothing happening there. It could just be that we're not out there enough. Now, as far as the South China Sea, that is a very significant area geopolitically, of course. And yes, I have tracked a number of cases at various locations in the South China Sea, including some near the coast of near Vietnam and Cambodia, and then also out into kind of the open waters between, you know, Asia and say like the Philippines or Taiwan. And a lot of these are U.S. Navy cases. And in fact, the most that I've tracked in the South China Sea are U.S. Navy cases, where the U.S. Navy is very active in that area. And typically, you know, you get these stories from some Navy guy who retired years before, and now it's 25 years later, and he finally feels that he can tell his story about this incredible thing that happened to him on his ship. So there's a lot of that. But I will also say that South China Sea, the Strait of Malacca as well, which is between Singapore and Sumatra, it's a major choke point. You got weird things happening in these waters going back centuries. centuries. Sometimes they're of craft, but sometimes, particularly in the 19th and in part of the 20th century, there are these very bizarre, almost luminous pinwheels that people have noticed under the water. I have no idea what those things are. I don't think that they're a natural phenomenon. I know some oceanographers think that. I don't think so. These things are way, they're too exact. They're too massive. They spin so rapidly, according to all the witnesses. They're very precise. Some of them seem to be maneuvering or moving. And all of these, that whole part of the world there, lots and lots of these types of things happening. Lots of questions, not enough answers, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, it's generally the case, is there not enough answers. Now, you've analyzed, I think you mentioned in the book, over 700 cases. Is that correct?
Just under, yeah, just about 700.
And that's just this one book?
No. So that's all three. So in this book, I have just under 200 cases. That's it.
Right.
I have a very long introduction, which explains the entire trilogy. I have a very long appendix, which is itself 35 pages, where I do a detailed data analysis of all of the facts that I got from all three volumes. So
you've got on your website, don't you have an Excel file?
Yeah, it's just a PDF, but you download it, and that itself is more than 35 pages also, and each page is big. But you can zoom right in. It's very easy to read. I would say it's a free download. Anyone can get it, but you're better off if you actually have the book. It helps.
Yeah, because exactly. I would think that it's not useless without the book, but the book's so full of insight. I it's a remarkable journey. It's like all of your books. I mean, you know, you're a very, very bright guy. It's the truth. And you have, you know, you've got a lot of valuable things to say. Speaking of which.
I just wanted to thank you. But I just want to say this book, this project, is a true labor of love. I've found it absolutely beyond fascinating. I would call it mind-blowing for the most part. And every book project, you know this well, can be frustrating, can be annoying. There's days when you don't want to do it. But in this case for me, and I had those days, of course, but overall, this was an absolute joy and one of the most fascinating projects I've ever done. I'm so glad I did it.
Incidentally, since we're talking now to my subscribers who are the committed people who are serious about this, in my opinion, the most serious ones, don't forget, if you appreciate the book and get the book, to go on Amazon and review it, because Richard, like me, is an independent author. I have my own little company, Richard does too, to publish our book, and we need those reviews.
It does help.
Yes, Richard also has got some, and I promise to mention these over the course of the show, some great comments. This is Carl Nell, whom I know very vaguely, and Richard obviously knows a little better than I do. Richard Dolan has done it again. No one previously had the stamina nor desire to sort through the morass of case lore to find the jewels. And that's exactly why you need the book. And I am advertising the book now, not just the lists that he's got available. Okay.
Thank you. That's very nice to hear that.
Well, yeah, I'm an author too. I know how important it is. And anyway, what are we doing here if people aren't reading these books and being changed by them? That's what we're here for.
Yeah, we're in an era where it really doesn't seem people read less than they used to. Things are on video, audio. I get it. It's all good. But there really is no comparison between even great podcasts and a book. The amount of information in any book, typical book will have 100,000 words or more. That's a lot of information. Yeah. And a book is organized in a way, hopefully, that it's presented in a way that the information should be. And I think really there are still advantages that a book will have that other media just do not have.
Yes. Now, in the looking over the whole book, there are numerous cases where electromagnetic interference takes place.
Yes, it's very important. There are
missing time cases. Yep. And I got the impression, and I must say, I probably would have to go through the book a second time to be sure of this, or you may even mention it, in which case I'm embarrassed, but is there a connection between, are there a lot? Yeah, there is a connection. Okay, tell
us about that. There's absolutely a connection. This is one of the most crazy things that I discovered in the course of doing this. So let me just back this up. So my initial intention was not to do a statistical breakdown of these cases. I wasn't thinking like that. I was just thinking, I want to breathe life into these dead cases. I want people to know about them. I want to make them vivid and exciting. So after I did all of that, I was having a conversation with my wife, Tracy, and she said, you know, it would be a great idea if you just created like categories for each case, like as a quick reference guide for each case, like, what color was the craft? What shape was the craft? How close was the witness? What was the craft doing? Was it in the water? Did it emerge from the water? All of these things. And as soon as she said it, I knew instantly that that was a great idea. And also that I didn't really want to implement it because I knew it would be a lot of work. I did do it. It took several months. I had to go back over everything. And I created about 15 categories. And I extracted data, all that data from every single case. And I put that in there. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to put this into a spreadsheet, which I'm no spreadsheet king by any means, but I created this massive spreadsheet, all 672 cases, all of these categories. One of the things that I included was effects, different type of effects, including electromagnetic effects. I thought this is noteworthy. And this is what I discovered. So I got my first EM interference case from the early 50s with USOs. I'm sure there were earlier ones with UFOs, but in the books, the cases that I found, the first one happened in 1951. Okay. And electromagnetic interference simply means, is it interfering with your electronic systems or your communications, or is there something noteworthy where something gets shut down in terms of the operation, right? So I decided from 1951 to the present, what percentage of cases that I found have electromagnetic interference. And the answer is 9.5%. It's almost 1 out of 10. It's quite significant. But where it really gets interesting is where I separate out a couple of factors. One was military. So military encounters are twice as likely as civilian encounters to have EM interference. Communications go down, electronics of some sort go down, computers. Twice as likely. That's a significant difference for sure. And even more, in the few instances where witnesses reported missing time or sighting of a being in connection with the USO. So those two categories, that's about 6% of all of the cases that I have. It's not a huge amount, but it's still significant. In those cases, the electromagnetic interference is 4 times above the average. And I look at that and I think this was not something that I was looking for. It was something that I found upon review of the massive amount of data that I collected. And I cannot believe that that is a random occurrence. There's something there. Now, to me, these types of patterns speak to several things. One, it gives me confidence in the authenticity of the data, that there are these very distinctive patterns that are noticeable upon review. So that's one thing. So it gives me confidence in the cases. The other thing is it tells us a little bit about the behavior of these beings, that A, they can distinguish between military and non-military vessels. You'd expect that, but it's nice to be able to see these behavioral differences in the data. And then also, it does make me think that these missing time cases are probably legit. They're reporting the same types of phenomena across decades, across geographic regions. And it indicates to me that these beings, the aliens, let's just say, when they come in for someone to take them, they are making sure that they are, at least in many cases, disabling the electronics and whatever systems may be in play at that time. So all of this is logical. It's not something that I would have predicted beforehand, but it's right there in the data. And I talk about this at great length in the appendix of this book, but also, as I said, the spreadsheet is a free download on my website and is indicated by links in the ebook and in the print book. So it's, you can go to my website and just and search USO spreadsheet, and it's a free download.
The another thing that I have noticed that it, you mentioned 1967, it's kind of before 1967 and after 1967, there was a shift to from day to night. Yes. And the military encounters also rose dramatically after 1967.
Yeah,
in other words, is there something in that year that would explain this?
Okay, this is very important. So what I noted, one of the factors that I recorded in these all of these encounters is a very simple thing. Did it happen during daylight or at night? It's not always possible to know, like, what hour did it happen at? That we don't usually get that level of specificity. But I was able to see, like, was it daylight or night in most of the cases that I researched. So that was a worthwhile thing. And then what I noticed is that up until about 1967, I say about, and I'll explain why in a minute, but up until the end of 1967, just over half of all of the cases that I had recorded up to that point took place in daytime, 51%. So it's not overwhelming. It's roughly half and half. However, after that, from January 1st, 1968, in other words, to the present now, 74% of all cases have taken place at night. And through the 1970s, like, you know, the first decade of that, they're overwhelmingly at night. So it's a very dramatic change. And military encounters, incidentally, were even more so at night. Military encounters since the late 60s have been, I think, 87 or 88% at night. It's overwhelming. I mean, it's shocking, frankly. And to me, this, again, speaks to behavioral, decisions that they make about us. They can distinguish between the military and the non-military. Civilian encounters are far more likely to be in the daytime than military. So they know that. And yeah, so the change in behavior, I've wondered about this a lot. Also, electromagnetic interference cases went up very much in the 1970s as well. And that's another behavioral change. Now, when I break it down by the shapes of craft, so there's disc shape, there's spherical, there's cigar shaped, and so forth. They don't all change at the same time. Some change a little earlier to predominantly nighttime. Some change a little bit later. But by 1970, they were all predominantly at night. So it was a changeover. Now, you know, part of it might just be I have a limited amount of data, and some might have seemed to go over to nighttime earlier than others. I don't know. But I'm working with close to 700 cases, so it's not the worst data sample. But why? Why? I don't know exactly why, but I would suspect my first answer, why go to nighttime? Perhaps because they started to realize that our own capabilities by the late 60s in detection were becoming pretty good. Like, we were starting to put satellites up in orbit. By the late 60s, we actually were starting, they were becoming useful in tracking what was going down. We were developing better and better electronic detection techniques. And I can only speculate, but I wonder, did they decide, well, we'll come out at night, we'll shine a bright light at them so they can't see us very well. And that might disguise us a little bit. Because that's what it seems like to me. That's what it seems like. A behavioral change of some sort.
It's almost, and also, you know, that's when the abductions began to ramp up as well in the 70s.
That's a very astute observation. It's true. You know, we could argue, well, there have been abductions earlier. Yeah, probably, but we have very few, comparatively very few reports prior to the 70s. It really goes crazy in the 70s.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, when you, it goes crazy in the 70s, begins to slowly trail off in the 80s and 90s. And then in the 2000s, the early 2000s, it ends as if it was some kind of a program that was going on, and that it had a beginning, middle, and end. And the thing that's fascinating here is that, you know, I wondered, could it be that there was some kind of attempt being made on our part to defend ourselves, and that the movement of the USOs to, which are also, of course, UFOs that came from underwater. I mean, in other words, they're USOs when they're underwater and UFOs when they're out in the sky.
Yeah.
So a UFO that's flying over your house could easily have been a USO 2 minutes ago.
It could have.
Yeah.
Yeah. The shapes are almost, the shapes are identical. The USO shapes are identical to that of aerial UFOs. I don't think there's
really which gets us back to the whole idea of bases. Maybe they're based underwater because it's probably much easier for them to get to than drilling down through miles and miles of rock, and very difficult for us to get to.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I agree with this. I caught a really astute comment by Kevin Newth, who also is one of the people who gave a nice blurb for my book. But Kevin is great, and he's a PhD, teaches over at the University of Albany. And he noted, he said, look, you know, the oceans are actually a very, can be a very logical place for alien civilization to set up. There's a lot of protection that the water provides. It can protect you from harmful radiation from the sun. If you are not used to that level of radiation, the ocean is a perfect place to go. It's also a stable environment in terms of temperature and pressure and all of these other things that, you know, you want. And then, of course, it is secure from the prying eyes of humans for the most part.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot, if you've got the technology and the capability to set up operations deep in the water, it could be a very attractive proposition.
Now, I think we're coming to the pretty close to the end of the show. So I'm going to end with, you mentioned Kevin Newth, who is a great guy. I do know him a bit. And I want to end with what he says about this book. Precisely when scientists around the world are working up to the UAP UFO phenomenon, Dolan delivers his book on unidentified submerged objects, emphasizing the long-ignored fact that UFOs are linked to our oceans, lakes, and rivers. These fascinating accounts make clear that we are confronted with a persistent global mystery whose complexity runs deep. The book is a necessity for anyone interested in understanding UAP, UFO, USO phenomena. And in order to understand who they are and where they are coming from, it is essential to understand how they have based themselves on Earth. And this is where they're based, underwater. Richard, I want to thank you for a tremendously important book. And it is only the beginning of a 3-volume series that is going to take the human mind to another level in its understanding of what this is. Richard Dolan, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Whitley. This is a delight to be here with you. And I'll just remind people, all the cases for volumes 2 and 3 are all written up, but I do need to kind of organize them and put them into chapters and so forth. But they'll all be out this year, and I'm very happy about it. And incidentally, I'm very much looking forward to reading your Fourth Mind. This is an area that I am very much interested in, and I'm particularly interested in your insights about this alien mind, physiology, behavior. Absolutely, I think it's very timely as well. So I hope that we get to talk about that. Maybe I can invite you onto my channel for a conversation about that sometime. I'd be happy.
Sure thing. I'm ready to go. Just say the word.
The deal. Yeah, well, I want to read it first, but
I would like that. That would be nice. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being on Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week.
Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.